in this space who's trying to go independent, what's their number one fear? What's the number one hang up keeping people from going out on their own?
Welcome to another episode of the Rogue Startups Podcast with Craig Hewitt and Dave Rodenbaugh. This is a podcast documenting the journey as self-funded business founders and sharing lessons, tips, and tricks for businesses following the same path as ours. The journey is long and winding, but we're glad you're joining us for it. And now it's time to go rogue with Dave and Craig.
All right, guys, this week on the show, Dave and I are excited to bring on Breck Palumbo from the Bootstrap with Kids podcast and founder of Distressed Pro. How you doing, man?
Good. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, you know, we were talking a bit right before we started recording, aside from, sound checking and whatnot and vasectomy jokes, but talking a bit about how, and maybe it's a little selfish on my end, I guess, but our paths may be sort of going down a similar road where you're both a non-technical founder and have a background in sales in your previous life. And so I guess in general, kind of wanted to... It is, isn't it? Because you can look back and say, oh, that was fucked up, and this is so much better now, right?
And at least you know how to sell things.
Well, that's a good point. That's a good point. Talk about that. How has your previous experience in sales sort of transitioned over, and what doesn't work?
Sure. So, yeah, previous sales experience, I sold technical training and consulting, and then I sold software at an enterprise and government level, and then I sold real estate, and then I sold real estate at the institutional level. So that's kind of the background. And it's this process of selling online is very different from the enterprise sales or from the institutional sales. But the thing that I think stays the same is the human nature and being able to tap into that and wants and needs and fears and desires and all that kind of thing. And also just really having a voice. One of the things that I started doing in real estate, and this was sort of early 2000s, I started getting into a lot of direct response type of marketing. And at that time, there wasn't that much that you could do online, but I did have, I've got I hope people don't go try to find it, but, I've got a first YouTube video in 2000 and I don't know, it was way early where I'm like crawling around a foreclosed home. and stuff like that.
It's like the property guys in the early days, right?
Yeah. And so I, through learning the direct response marketing, all that stuff translates over. The only difference is the delivery method. And so I'd say the biggest thing that I took with me from sort of the old school, other than the just basic selling skills and human nature and pulling out pain and then solving the pain and all that, is direct response. And that's definitely been the biggest thing, that's contributed to whatever level of success I've had online has largely been due to the skills that are brought over from the direct response marketing. I ran ads in newspapers, advertorials, those where it looks like a story, but it's got a thin outline around the outside of it and says advertisement at the bottom, but it's written like a story with a call to action.
Oh, yes.
I sent all kinds of really highly tailored direct mail. So I'd pick a really narrow band of targets. I'd customize the letter, with sort of an advanced mail merge kind of thing. I did all that kind of stuff, all the stuff that you can do now with email or on a sales page. And so the deal is getting the message in front of the right people and then knowing how to convert them from there. And that doesn't change whether you're sending a postcard or an email or, what have you. So that was the biggest thing that I brought from my sales career for sure.
So when you're a tech guy, there's a lot of places that you kind of get bogged down as a single founder. And it seems like there's a lot of, I don't want to do the sales and marketing. And so I'll go over here in the development where things are safe and I know what's going on and I'll just stick with that. Where do you find yourself getting bogged down? Because, not being the tech guy, you're not going to go run and hide in code because it's not the place that you feel the most comfortable, right?
Oh, I've done it. And I would say that has been, it's not anymore, but there was a time when I was learning to code and just taking on too much of that stuff myself and taking too long to execute and executing poorly. So I did really have to get away from that, but I did that for a long time and I learned a lot, but I at some point realized that I was never going to be as proficient as somebody who I could hire for much, much less, like not for a livable wage for me, for my, you know, for my needs. And it just didn't make sense. It was not the best place for me to be spending my time. So, you know, after I realized that, I really tried to abandon it. I still get sucked into some things. Like I'm very particular on I don't like to leave a lot to chance on the UI. And so when the developer that I have now, extremely strong on the back end, but I probably get involved too much in, you know, laying out exactly what I want to do. Or maybe I don't, but I find myself, that's where I get bogged down, is once I have to go into code, open the inspector, you know, do all that kind of stuff. And, you know, that's a frustration. There's a lot of different things I want to do to connect different apps and, you know, make things work the way that you want to work them. If I was a developer, I could just sit down, whip that out, and it'd be good. Instead, what I have to do is spec it, communicate it, pay for it, test it, you know, do it again. You know, that slows you down, but I think at this point, I've got enough of a system down for that where it's not consuming that much time.
So I know you gave a MicroConf talk, I guess it would be 2 years ago now, talking about how you developed your MVP 3 years ago now as a non-technical founder and developing an MVP. Folks can go look it up, and it's a really good talk. I think I've listened to it a couple of times because I'm going to start going through a similar process soon. But you know, I guess aside from what is in the talk and talking about your system a little bit, what have you learned that you kind of take forward as far as systems and whatnot?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
So as a non-technical founder, outsourcing and developing an app or a software product, what kind of things have you learned that you would maybe do differently next time that you didn't do the first time?
First thing is that I jumped into software too quickly. I should have continued doing what I was doing for a much longer period. It would, had I done that, so I probably haven't seen my talk or whatever. I'm not sure who the audience is, but if you haven't or you don't know the story, I started with a PDF. So what my product does, what Distress Pro does, is that I compile all kinds of bank and credit union and other data, including contact data and the things. It's basically a sales intelligence software in a really narrow niche. And the way that it started off, however, was just PDF reports of this same data. And had I persisted with that until it just kind of ran its course, I probably could have paid for everything without, you know, coming out of pocket. I was so eager to develop software that I, in the recurring revenue and all that stuff we dream about, that I jumped into that really, really quickly, like only after a few weeks of proving out the product or proving out the demand. So were I to do that again, I would have approached that completely differently. I also wasn't building an audience at the time. I borrowed somebody else's audience to start, and then I started building an audience after that. What I would do today is begin by building out the audience, talking about the problem, collecting email addresses. Then I would release a product that did not involve software, if at all possible. And I would run that for as long as it would sell, because there's no reason to move up or on until you've really exhausted a thing, I think. And so that's the biggest thing I would do different. I think a lot of us, especially on the non-technical side, it's so sexy, you know, the idea that somebody's going to be billed every single month and they're going to, you know, be showing up. But it's a fucking, do you guys swear on the show?
Loads, yeah.
No, we're totally, yeah. We're totally pussy about that. Yeah, fuck that.
That's a fucking lot to take on, especially when you're a non-technical founder. So to the extent that you can, you know, do the Wizard of Oz thing where you kind of, you know, there's someone behind the curtain, I would do that. I would, and I that's what I should have done. And I probably could have carried that a couple of years, especially in the market that I'm in, sort of an older market. They're used to older technology. They do things like buy spreadsheets of data, and they do things like buy PDF reports for $500. There's no reason why I had to go and build. The thing that I did right when I did build was I moved very, very quickly. I put out a product that, so I started, the timeline's kind of like this. I started thinking about this in May. I read the 4-Hour Work Week, which is so cliche, but I did, and a bunch of other stuff, and sort of a binge reading vacation kind of thing in June. And I had hired folks. I had proven the thing out, hired folks, and then had a product built by August 31st. So you can imagine what it looked like. But people still showed up and paid within a couple of months. So what I did right there was move really fast, not be embarrassed. I wasn't embarrassed. I mean, I was embarrassed about the product, but not enough to not put it out and ask for money for it, with the assumption that I just offer a refund. And, if people didn't like it. And so that worked. And so I would do that. However, I would have given myself a much longer period with the non-software product before that.
And when you say sort of tapping out a market or you know, getting everything you can out of a market, you mean sort of like penetration into market share or something like that, or offering all of the services or non-software products that you can to a market?
I think that when you're offering a product, we, as the developers of the product or as the creators, can get bored with it. We can get bored with the pitch. We can always believe that there needs to be something more for it. But the fact is that if you put it out to a bigger audience and you just work on adding more people to your audience, then you're going to know when it's time to move on when sales slow down. And I didn't get there by any means.
So would you say that there was some particular, you know, I don't believe in silver bullets or magic questions, but I mean, it's obvious that you tapped into something pretty quickly. So you must have asked some very good questions of your customers, or you had a good audience to sort of work with. I mean, right now, obviously, I'm post Support Vine and trying to do customer development on new ideas right now. So this is very timely for me. What would you say to anybody in our audience or to me about like customer development and what made your customer development particularly successful in this case?
Well, I was the customer in this case, and I worked with all of the customers. So I was in real estate. I was selling assets for institutions. I didn't have a Rolodex, but my whole Rolodex was full of other people just like me with the same problem. So it was very much scratching your own itch. And I was already like really in tune with what that market was trying to do at that particular time.
Damn it.
So I don't know how you replicate that. But that's where where I was. Now, since then, I've released another product that it's still very like nascent. We're just beginning with it. And we did it while I was on the road, which we can talk about later. And so I have spent no time on it at all. But the reason that the product was developed was because I did really extensive surveys, repeated surveys with my existing audience over a long period of time, like a year or two, just kind of getting a feel for what are the real pains that you're having here? What are the real troubles? How are you going to solve them? You know, how are you going about solving them now? Are you even going about solving them now? And then coming up with a solution for that. I mean, once you have an audience, then that's what you should be doing. You should be, which is why I say I would begin by building the audience, were I to begin again, because I could have simply asked them. Now, at that time, I happened to be, like I said, deeply in it. So maybe didn't need to do so much of that. But moving forward, it was a lot of asking a lot of questions from an awful lot of email subscribers.
So did you actually use a survey, or did you do one-on-one emails, or like get on the phone?
I did not get on the phone. I did two things primarily. One is that in every autoresponder sequence that I get in, whenever you subscribe, one of the first things that I do is you get an email and I say, hey, reply to me. And here's why. And what I want to know about is what you're dealing with, what you're struggling with, what you're trying to do. If what I have isn't what you're isn't going to solve those problems, then I'm going to tell you, you'll save a lot of time. And if there's another resource, I'll point you to that. So that's the first thing. And I got a ton of email replies from that. So the other thing I say is that all the emails I'm going to send you are going to be really important. If you reply to me now, there's a higher likelihood that they're going to hit your inbox. And so people tend to reply. Sometimes it's just a couple of words. Sometimes they tell me their whole life story. You know, you never know, but I do that. And the other thing is just a survey into a Google spreadsheet and then normalizing that and looking for the patterns. And another thing that I did was I set up a thing where if you replied to the email, I would take the response, parse that into a Google spreadsheet. And then we went through and we looked for patterns in that. Like, what's the number one thing that people are looking for? What are the biggest problems? And we came up with some answers. So.
And I did this recently with our customers for Podcast Motor. And it was, I mean, it's just magic. It was amazing. I mean, I sent it to 20, 25 people. I got a dozen responses, which I think is pretty good. And it was just amazing. I mean, it was just amazing. They were very consistent. They were very insightful. And I did the same thing. I asked two questions. Kind of one was, what can our service do better? And what sort of technology are you not getting out of podcasting right now? What need do you have from a technology standpoint? And I mean, it was great. And those are, they're my target customer and my existing customer. And yeah, those results should set me on my path for the next, I don't know, 6 months. That's real prime time data. Yeah, it's awesome.
That's great. Yeah. And so, you know, the two biggest responses that I had were, number one was, you know, generically leads. I need more leads. And the number two response was financing. We're having trouble, you know, getting financing. This is from many hundreds of people. So I could go try and open a financing arm. And I actually kind of took a stab at that for a little bit and found out it was too much work and I had to be around and talking to people and doing things. And, you know, who wants to do that? And so
that sounds like work. Yeah.
The other one was the leads, which I know how to do. So we went down that path.
So I know that from following the podcast that you have incorporated a big component of educational products in your business. I don't know, talk a little bit about maybe, you know, how they came about, why it's so important in general, kind of what the revenue breakdown is between that and your service or your product business.
Sure. On the front end, there's the free training. And what I began with was a 14-day free email mini course where I teach you everything you need to know about how to go bank direct for non-performing loans in REO. And that was the promise. And that's what it was. And it was really thorough. It was also sort of amateurishly written or whatever. And so it's been since revamped a couple of times. But that kind of series, the upfront series, accounts for almost 70% of my sales, you know, in terms of in through the funnel. And then the rest are sort of direct, or they act over, you know, the first interaction, or else it's much, much further down the road. What I found was that I got sort of on a deep segmentation kick to find out really who the people are, who are coming, what they're trying to do. And what I found out through a variety of tests was that people fall into three categories when they come to Distress Pro. So they either have money, they're looking to invest it themselves. Maybe they represent some private equity. Maybe they have their own cash, but they're looking to put it to work. The second is the sort of the professional who's a broker, and this is what they do, and they get paid on transactions. And then the third, which is the largest in probably any air finger quotes, like make money market or vertical. And so there's sort of the aspirational. So there's the aspirational, the professional, and then the I call them the acquisitions folks. And these people all need different things. And the people who are aspirational need to learn what the fuck they're doing, because otherwise they're going to come use my software. It's going to be a total pain in the ass. I don't want you to sign up if you're aspirational, because you don't know what to do. You don't know what to say. You don't know, you know, none of it.
Yeah, you're not going to extract value out of it.
Right, exactly. So you're going to cancel, you're going to give me a bad review, and it's, you know, it's not good for anybody. And so what I put together was the academy. And so I have three levels of the academy following the, if you remember the talk from Delk from Gumroad about with the pricing, I've got, you know, 100 and 2.2 and 5X. training program that I open, very similar to Micropreneur Academy, after chatting a little bit with Rob Walling about how he's doing that, where it only opens periodically. So there's a time frame during which you can enroll. Happens every 4 to 6 weeks, and there you have three packages that you can choose from, and then you go through there, and that's what the academy looks like. And there's increasing levels of both content and personal response from me that you get. So at the top level, I'll review your script is basically what the big selling point is on that. And I teach you how to write, you know, a proper script for prospecting these folks. That accounts for now, one of the challenges being on the road is that there are a couple of months where I just forgot to launch the thing. I just didn't do it. And so, I don't know. Whatever. But I think as of right now, it's about 40%, 30 to 40, mid 30% of total revenue.
And with not a lot of ongoing work, I would guess.
I built it last May in about a week and I've made two update videos since. Yeah. It's the best money. It is. I mean, info products are the best money. They just are. They are the lowest support. They're the most durable. They never crash. People perceive a lot of value in them. I should do more of them.
And just, I mean, there's a million ways to do it. WordPress, not WordPress, hosted kind of on a managed platform. How do you have it set up technically?
I use MemberMouse on WordPress.
Okay. And then Wistia?
I do use Wistia, but not for those videos. I use Amazon S3 and an S3 plugin.
Cool.
I use Wistia for my marketing videos and an S3 on the training videos.
Cool. Cool.
So both Craig and I have been following Bootstrap with Kids for a long time at this point, and we're both big fans of you and Scott. Craig noted this, and after he pointed it out, I was like, yeah, I think you're right. That both of us have kind of noticed that you've become a little more liberal over time. So what? Why?
Oh, I know in the last episode you were itching to talk more of it, but didn't want to fly off the handle. But
why would you say that is?
Why would you say that it's liberal?
I'm gonna toss that back to Craig.
Yeah, no, I guess I don't know. I kind of, you know, following the show, kind of saw you're going through the trip last year and kind of seeing some of the, you know, environmental things, and I guess that's what really pops into my head is maybe just the level of awareness around some of those things that I would classify as liberal. I spent some time out west, and you know, Dave's in Denver. I lived in San Diego for a few years, and definitely get that sort of feel. I don't know. Is it just the time out there and being aware of those things, you think, as opposed to living in the Northeast?
Well, you know, we're fairly liberal in the Northeast, in case you...
Yeah.
Well, okay. Shocker. Yes. There might be a few blue states up there. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So where all of the production and brain power comes from in the states. But now I'm going to be attacked. I actually don't feel that way at all. Here's the thing. I think I wouldn't classify myself as a liberal. I would say that I'm very anti-establishment. I feel like we're at a point today where we are basically an oligarchy. And I would find anyone with any data at all would have a hard time arguing that. I reject that. I think that that's fucked. And, it would be hard for you to spend a year on the road in all of the places that I've been and see what we're doing environmentally and see the way that people are living, and then to go and appreciate some of what is left and not be impacted by that. And I was impacted by it. Everywhere that you go, there's a fucking crisis, and it's not a little crisis. It's a big crisis, especially when you consider what comes after it, whether it's bats or bees or water. Or that you've fracked fucking Oklahoma so much that they get hundreds of tremors a day. I mean, there's a lot of shit. Or if you're farming rice in the middle of the goddamn desert in Texas, we're doing a lot of stupid shit. And we have one planet. And so I don't feel like having a serious environmental bent makes me necessarily liberal, but it is, in my mind, the only issue. It's just the top issue. I mean, there's no friggin' economy. There's no lifestyle. There's no, you know, if the environment's fucked, we're all fucked, period. And if you go around and you start visiting places and talking to people, rangers, universities, all this kind of thing, which we did, you will learn that we have mounting crises everywhere. And, you know, I've got kids. I've got three kids. So are we going to be sitting in a desert eating fucking crickets, watching the water roll up, you know, a couple feet every year? It doesn't sound like anything that I want. And maybe that sounds extreme, but I think until you've been out there and have like really seen what's going on with your own eyes and talk to people who are like ground floor or ground zero, I mean, it's shocking. It's disturbing. You know, on other fronts, I was raging against the police a little bit last week. Personally, if you're listening to this, you're a cop, whatever, my apologies. I grew up with nothing but trouble from overfunded, bored cops who had nothing to do. And, you know, so far this year, have killed 855 citizens so far this year. I mean, if you don't think that the police are overreaching, if you don't think that we're over-militarizing them, you've got your head up your ass, because meanwhile, we're delivering like armored vehicles to small towns in flak jackets. We had our high school, the last town that I was in, is like considered one of the best school systems in New Hampshire, which some people think is an oxymoron, but it's in Exeter where, you know, Phillips is and all that. And, you know, they storm the high school on a tip in full riot gear and dogs looking for drugs, come up with nothing. What the fuck are you going to expect from these kids when they're coming out of there knowing that at any moment you might have the fucking stormtroopers in there? This is one story, didn't get reported anywhere, of many thousands. I mean, I could go on. Do you want to talk about Citizens United? Do you want to talk about the fact that everybody that I hear from in this space who's trying to go independent, what's their number one fear? What's the number one hang up keeping people from going out on their own? Fucking A. It's ridiculous. You know, meanwhile,
healthcare.
Yeah. Meanwhile, a little pudgy face Albanian bitch is jacking up goddamn, you know, pill prices at 5,000%. Does this make any sense? You know, and we're advertising drugs to people every single night, all night on TV, where, you know, we're going to fix your restless legs. You might bleed out of your eyes and, you know, in other places. I mean, I object to this. So at the same time, I'm probably kind of libertarian and very conservative in a lot of other ways. I don't see any reason for us to be insuring school debt. It's fucking foolish. Anytime you make debt too easy or too cheap to get, it's going to explode the cost of a thing. That's a fact. I don't think that we should have Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, you know, propping up I don't think we should have corporate subsidies on corn or oil. So I wouldn't say that I'm liberal. I'd say that I take a measured approach to, you know, different issues. And I like to be educated about what they are. Fuck the Fed, by the way. Let's say that. Was that long enough?
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah. No, I think so. You know, what's interesting about this sort of group and people that would listen to this podcast or listen to yours is I think people are highly aware of what's going on. That's why they're doing something as crazy as starting their own online business. But they're doing it because they see kind of a lot of these environmental things, environmental being, you know, political or the actual environment or money or risk or anything like that, and want to do something about it and take matters into their own hands and whatever that means to them. So yeah, I think that getting out, and whether it's driving an RV across the country or just traveling more or homeschooling your kids or whatever, and giving yourself and your family the opportunity to see things differently is super healthy. So I certainly didn't mean the question to be negative. I think it was sort of a compliment to say that I could see you becoming more aware, I guess, on the air. Which is,
well,
cool.
I didn't take it as negative, but I do have some strong opinions on a number.
Yeah,
of
that's
topics.
Cool. That's cool.
Well, I think that makes somebody actually interesting because, you know, you don't want to be one of those milquetoast people that basically is saying, oh, everything's fine. There's really no problems. Yeah, you know, I go collect my paycheck and, you know, I'm going to stay at home and drink beer and watch TV and life is grand. You know, I think that's a very defeatist and ignorant attitude. And I definitely don't think that that's going to be making the world better. So, yeah, I'm totally on board with you, man.
Yeah, I mean, by and large, you know, most people are hiding in their televisions, you know, every night. They're scared to death because they're constantly fed that stuff and they're not, you know, and they're not doing anything. So thank God for us guys.
Saving the world.
There you go. Thank God for us. That's the quote of the episode. Oh, I'm sure that's going to get tacked onto the front of it now. That's great.
So now that I've ruined your podcast, what else do you want to talk about?
No. So, you know, one of the other things that we, you know, that we both sort of, you know, in following your show from last year, earlier this year, I guess, talking about, you know, Distress Pro, where it is a pretty mature business and sort of plans for the future. I know you had sort of toyed with the idea of potentially selling it before, and, you know, not to ask what those plans are now, but kind of what your mindset is around buying and selling assets online, maybe, and, you know, if that's a goal in general.
Yeah, it is a goal. I think anybody who starts a business has ideas at some point of exiting, you know?
Yeah.
And certainly I have those ideas. You know, one of the things I'm struggling with right now, my mastermind group is kind of, they're trying to corral me in the right direction, is that I do have this asset and it's been going pretty well and it's increasing every year, but it's not astronomical. It's, you know, increasing by not quite 30%. You know, first it was 180%, then it was 100%, then it was 70%, then it was 30%. So it's like that. One of my mentors said, like, it's never seen something, a business where it sort of started to reach a plateau and then suddenly, boom, you know, it's blowing up. Just doesn't really happen. So I'm at a point where I know that. You know, logically, I understand that, but I feel like there's still a lot that I haven't done. It's not even just the product, because the product I feel is really good, but yeah, I've never done paid advertising. So all the revenues, you know, organic and email. If I could figure out how to do that, you know, what could I do with it? I have done, you know, even though it is driven mostly by search, not until last May, really made a concerted effort to like target real keywords and do research on them and, you know, and make sure that everything was going the way that it should be. There's just a million things that I left undone and I hate that feeling. And so that's one consideration, although I'm trying to back away from that. The other consideration is that the amount that I could sell it for today, I don't know that it has the same value to me after taxes as it does if I hold the asset and treat it as an annuity where it's something that pays me. Like, what would it take for me to, what do I have to buy to have something that paid me what Distress Pro is paying me with the amount of effort that I'm putting in, which over the past year has been minimal. I had periods where I didn't work at all, you know, sometimes for weeks and then I binge work for a couple of days. And, you know, I had a long period where I didn't, you know, do anything and it still grew. So
binge work for a couple of days.
Yeah.
That we should all be so lucky.
Well, you know, if it's raining out, then that's a good time to work. So that's really what it comes down to is the math. So if I sold it today and I've got kind of some rough quotes from some of the better folks out there on what, you know, what they think I could get for it. And if I took that money and bought another asset, there's not commercial property that would pay me the same. There's not another website where if I put, you know, if I paid all cash, maybe I could do financing. I'm kind of debt adverse, but there's not really anything that I could do with that. So what it comes down to is the question of opportunity cost. So if I am still putting all of my time or whatever time I am working on putting into this, then, which is more now that I'm settling in Oregon. I am working, you know, so a more regular kind of a schedule. But if I devoted this time and effort to a bigger game, would I be better in 3 to 5 years? Would there be a better outcome? So I liquidate now, take the cash, and then turn my focus to something else. I think those are the considerations that you really have to get down to. Now, you know, I can't put the money in the bank. I'm not going to get anything there. I'm not going to put it in the stock markets. It's a casino and a crapshoot and a disaster at the moment. So, you know, what to do? Gold, I guess. I buy gold.
That's a disaster too. A friend of mine's in the mining business, and he's always constantly sweating the price of gold. And it seems like, you know, after we had that one run up after the past decade, it's kind of petered out and it's going up and down, and it's not really like a growth asset anymore. So
yeah,
I don't know that that's such a great move either.
No, I'm not going to buy. I'm not going to put it all in gold. But, and plus there's no annuity with gold. There's no, you know, you're not getting paid anything every month. And that, I mean, that's really what you need. You know, you got to pay bills. So I'm not going to sell and then draw down on the principal. That's fucking stupid. So that's where I'm at. I would like to sell. I need to be sure that what I'm going to dive into next is worthy effort to sell and kind of release that cash. And then it's going to be worthy of like the next 3 to 7 years or 10 years of my life, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense. So, I mean, we didn't really talk too much about you being on the road all the time, but you know, what would you say are like the best and toughest things about doing this? I mean, I know there's, you guys give updates all the time, but you know, just give us the Cliff Notes summary right now. What are the highlights and the lowlights that you would say are the things that you see constantly about it?
Yeah. Of being on the road full time, like traveling full time. I mean, the best part is, I mean, I've seen what my kids have seen more than most people will in their whole lives. We've been to, you know, you name it. We've been to the national park. We've seen all kinds of nature that you would never see. We've been able to live, you know, for periods of time in different places, like, you know, Durango and San Francisco and, you know, Bend and Asheville. And, you know, how else do you do that? How else would you do all that? The other thing is that I'm a foodie, love food, spend a ton of money at restaurants. And, I should probably roll that in now that we're settling down, and I love doing that all over the country, and you know, I'm a big outdoor sports guy. If you mountain bike and you're riding the same trails, you know, day after day, week after week, year after year, it's a drag. I've ridden. There's this thing called the International Mountain Bike Association 50 Epic Trails. I've ridden a bunch of them, you know, all over the country. So I don't know how else would you do that on a vacation? Probably not, you know?
Yeah. That's a lot of vacations. Certainly not 50. Yeah. That's 50 vacations. And most people, even if they're taking one every year, aren't going to be hit the mountain bike trail every day.
Yeah. Now I didn't hit them all, but nonetheless, you know, quite a few. And I love that. So on the negative side, I mean, it's taken me a couple of weeks after settling just to get back into a rhythm of doing anything, you know, on a consistent basis. I've got a Trello board full of shit that just had to be done by me. And I just couldn't, I just couldn't or wouldn't do it. I thought that we'd establish some kind of, you know, little routine or whatever. There's very little routine. It's really hard to have a routine, even pulling the Airstream or whatever. So we go to bed in the same place and all that. It's really hard to establish a routine. You don't know if you're going to have the internet. I couldn't do any webinars. We missed a bunch of calls. It's just sometimes you don't have the internet. So that's a drag. But other than that, I loved it. I think my family was done before I was, or at least sometimes they were, or some of them were some of the time. But it is, I plan to do more of it.
That's awesome. That's awesome. I hear a lot more people doing it. We're planning on doing it next year, in a different fashion, but just a long vacation, like 6 months.
Yeah. Well, I wasn't really totally a vacation. I did work. I mean,
oh, sure. Yeah. A long trip. Yeah.
Yeah. But the truth is, like, if you get Slack and Trello and that, and you're you've got a phone, you get an iPhone or whatever, you can get an awful lot done if you have people who can execute and who are, you're used to working with. And that, I mean, that was really the key. I could not have done this without my assistant this year. There's no way. I have, you know, been training him to take on more and more and more stuff. And he has accepted that. And then, you know, I increased his compensation. And I mean, he was a linchpin. Couldn't have done it without having somebody kind of at the helm.
Nice. So our last question is, I don't know, maybe it's becoming our signature question, but I really like it because I think it talks to a couple of things. But if you could give a talk at a conference on anything you want, where would it be and what would you want to talk about?
Well, I mean, MicroConf are my favorite people. There's, you know, no two ways about it. That is my favorite conference. And at some point I'll get to the one in Europe, but it is... the one in Vegas is worth it every time. I wish it happened more often. So I guess it would have to be at MicroConf that I would give the talk. The thing that I've really kind of latched onto over the last year or two is this, I've had these, you know, changes and done this stuff, is living intentionally. And what I found is that there are an awful lot of people out there who are just sleepwalking through life. They're not even sure how they got into the thing that they're doing now, or why they live where they live, or any of it, or why they do any of the things that they do, except that everybody else is fucking doing it. So, you know, that's what I should do. And I think that this is pure folly. Like, this is not the way to live a life. If you're not being intentional about what you're doing, then you're going to look up at some point. And it might not be now, or maybe it's when you're going to say, I wish I had fucking done that. Like, I would much rather regret having done a thing than not. And if you're not living intentionally, you're not going to do those things. You're going to do what everybody else is doing all the time. You know, commute 30 minutes to an hour and a half a day each way. You're going to go grind away at something where you're frustrated with all the stupid people you have to work with. And then you're going to come home, you're gonna, you know, maybe you get to a soccer game and you have some dinner, you watch some TV and do it again. And then you're going to look up and poof, you like your best years are fucking gone and your ankles don't work and you're moving around funny and it's over and, you know, hang it up. And I just don't want to ever be there. And so I guess that's what I'd talk about.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's awesome. You have such a great experience last year to really understand that firsthand and see what the value of being intentional and choosing your own way. They would be a great talk. Yeah.
Well, thanks.
I would definitely want to hear that at MicroConf. So I think you should submit it as an attendee talk next year. In fact, I'm going to start bugging Rob to bug you.
I don't know. It's pure ego thing. I don't want to do another attendee talk. I'd want to do a I'd want to do a big boy talk. But
okay, we'll let you
sit at the big kid table.
We won't put you at the kid table anymore. We'll let you sit at the grown-ups table this time.
We'll see. I don't know. It sounds like a lot of preparation and work, so
I'm sure that it would be, yes. But it would be pretty fun, I think.
Could be, yeah.
All right. Well, let's wrap this up here. So if people want to find out more about Distress Pro, you can go visit distresspro.com or follow Brecht on Twitter. Well, actually, I don't know what your regular Twitter handle is. I only know your Bootstrap WK one. What's your regular one?
Yeah, sure. It's my first name, which is Brecht. And then I've got an IFY, so Brechtify, at Brechtify on Twitter. And that's really the best place for these folks to reach me.
Okay, great. Well, thanks again for being on the show, Brecht. We appreciate it. And the next time we need a massive political rant, you'll definitely be the first guy that we call.
Thanks for having me on and tolerating my my liberalness.
Absolutely. We love it.
All right, guys.
All right, thanks.
Have a good one.
And that's our episode for this week. If you have any questions or comments, please let us know at podcast@roguestartups.com. Subscribe to us in iTunes by searching for Rogue Startups. And be sure to visit roguestartups.com for full show notes on each episode. If you're enjoying the show, we'd sure appreciate a review in iTunes. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.